Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The more you heal your trauma, the more you become your authentic self. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. So, for anyone who may not know, I'm currently taking a well-deserved break. However, I have put together something special for you today. The best of Joe Ryan. For anyone who may not be familiar with Joe, he is the host of the podcast, It's Not You, It's Your Trauma. Highly recommend checking that shit out. So he's been on the podcast 3 different times. So I have put together all of my favorite segments from those episodes. So that's what you're getting today. Another thing I wanted to draw your attention to, one of the members of the shit show, Jesse, recently launched his own podcast, Trauma Unbound. It is about CPTSD and parts work. Jesse is our parts guru, our internal family systems sage. So this past Shit Show Saturdays episode is the first episode of his podcast. Go check out that shit. Let's show him some shit show support. So let's get the damn show on the road. But first, of course, let's talk about what you, yes, you need to damn the join Shit Show, my online support community, where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. Now, I know that there are hundreds of you, if not thousands of you, listening to these words right now who do not have a peer support community, who desperately need a peer support community, especially a week before Christmas. Okay? So yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about we just do the damn thing? Damn the join shit show, less than $1 a day. This is relational trauma. We heal relational trauma and safe relationships. So see the link in the bio next. Give me a follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, give me a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all.
So I want to talk about you hitting your trauma bottom, like kind of your adult child bottom. And I know that you've had kind of two. So, yep. You know, I think we're similar in the sense that we grew up in dysfunctional families and then turned to drugs and alcohol, and then got sober when that stopped working. And then at a certain point in sobriety, all this shit kind of came to the surface. So I was just hoping that you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, I started drinking and drugging at an early age, you know, hospitalized at 17 for overdoing it a little bit and
a little bit,
you know, just a little bit, you know, waking up in the hospital was never fun. When I continued after that, it was just a way to eliminate the pain of being that was in, you know, all the trauma. And I didn't know what the word trauma was really until about 5 years ago. But, you know, when I first started drinking and drugging, it just shut down that part of my brain that just beat me up every single day, and the self-consciousness and, you know, always watching and being on guard. It took it away and I just felt like I was at home and there was a peace to it. But eventually all addictions fail and, you know, you wake up one day and you're like, I don't want to live this life anymore. And, you know, I cleaned up for a long time and, you know, got on track, had a business, a wife, kids, house, you know, living the life that I felt like I was raised to live. Like I didn't really have a plan B and it all fell apart on me and, you know, lost pretty much everything I'd built up my entire life in like a short 18-month period. And I just kind of bottomed out and, you know, I picked up again after 17 years and it was just a weird place to be, losing everything and realizing that I didn't have the strength and the energy to spend the next 20 years getting back to that place. And I didn't know how to go about living anymore. And then one night I picked up and I went real hard for a while. And it's amazing how fast you get back to where you were Like, it's just this, it's this drinking muscle memory where I thought it was going to be the slow progression of just having a couple of drinks here and there, but I was blacking out drinking within a month. And I woke up one day in somebody's backyard, didn't know where I was. And that was the, you know, the reality check that I needed. And I just kind of started to wean off of it again. And I tried to get myself back, but I was, you know, I was just sitting in the pain and the trauma. And I realized that nothing outside of myself was going to take it away anymore. And I just didn't know what to do with that. And for about 2 years, I was just like a walking zombie. And then I had this, you know, abuse trauma recall that I didn't know that it was there previously. And that really took me to the place I needed to go. Like, that was the ultimate bottom for me. I was raw. I was exposed. My entire reality that I had spent my life building, you know, was not there anymore. Like, I had this whole false self thing going on, and I felt like I perfected it. And then all of a sudden I had this memory of abuse, and I had to find out how to live with that. And it was just so painful. Like, I tried everything in recovery. I've read everything. I've listened to everything. I've written. When I went in and sat in the pain of the abuse for, you know, a couple of hours and then days and weeks after, I just kept feeling lighter by sitting in the fear and the pain and the hurt and reliving the abuse, you know, over and over again. Every time I had gone to it, I just felt emotionally lighter. There was less fear. There was less anxiety. There was less pain. And that was the big click for me. It was like, okay, this is the way we recover. We sit in our pain and we realize the reality of our life, not the lies that, you know, or the false self that you've kind of built up to cover up the shame and the hurt. It was actually to go in it and sit with it and re-experience it, to realize, to grieve it. Mm-hmm. It was a loss of childhood. It was a loss of innocence, to grieve that loss so that it didn't drive me anymore. It didn't drive my compulsions. It didn't drive my self-hate. It didn't drive the addictions. It was a way of freeing myself from it. Mm-hmm. And then you just keep doing it. Things start rising up. And you feel them and you learn how to process the hurt and the pain that's still trapped inside of you.
Mm-hmm. So when you drank after 17 years, obviously you have 17 years of 12-step recovery in your head. When you picked up that drink, what was that experience like? Was there any relief? Because I just feel like if I were to relapse, I feel like I would just feel immense guilt immediately. I don't even know if I would be able to enjoy it.
Well, I guess it's where I was at. I lost a multi-million dollar business. I lost my house, my wife, my kids half the time, my life savings. I met a woman after I gotten separated. We were about to move in and start our life together. She got hit by a car, didn't know who I was, got her back to health. Then I started dealing with the trauma of the car accident. And I kind of spiraled down, and she was like, I have too much work to do. I can't, you're detracting from me recovering. So basically the entire life I built up for years was gone, and I was just lost. And I went back to that familiar language, which was drinking. And, and I thought about it, you know, I was thinking about it. It wasn't like I just picked up one day. It was like, can I do this? Should I do this? I was so proud of the 17 years, and I'd become so empowered by not picking up for so long. I had nowhere to turn. I just felt completely alone in this world, and I couldn't stand the pain that I was living in, that the life that I spent decades creating was gone in 18 months. And I was just this lost little puppy out in this big, dangerous world. And that was the only way that I knew how to cope when things got that bad, that I went back to it. And I thought I was going to feel worse. Like you say, the guilt and all that, I really, truly thought I was going to feel worse. I think the thing that felt bad was that I did feel ashamed, you know, calling my sponsor and going, listen, I just threw away 17 years. And, you know, I felt like I disappointed myself and I disappointed other people, but I didn't know how to live with what I was dealing with alone and sober. And that was it. And I was off and running, but it didn't, you know, it didn't last long, that heaviness. Like, I'm glad that I went hard quick and then had that slap in the face of where's my car, whose backyard am I sleeping in, and how did I get here? It's like we don't want to live this way anymore. We know this life. We've done it. It's played out. It's not going to lead anywhere. And that was the climb back up from there.
I know there's a stupid expression that like your disease is whenever we're in a meeting, our disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups.
It was always stronger than me for a very long time. Absolutely. I was on the couch drinking and the disease was working out in the backyard.
Oh, so my experience was that I always knew that aspects of my childhood were less than ideal. But I thought that since I was never physically abused or sexually abused, how could it truly have impacted me that much? So when I hit this bottom, it was more so a realization of how much my childhood really did fuck me up. And so when you had that trauma recall, had you completely dissociated to where you didn't remember any of the abuse, or you were similar to me, were like, things were less than ideal, but it wasn't that bad?
Well, I knew a lot of the abuse, but, you know, it's just this one, I had no idea that it was there. But, you know, I knew a lot of the abuse and, you know, I was working through it. And for me, the physical abuse is the easiest for me to work through. It was that slow drip of emotional conditioning of being molded into what, you know, my source figures needed me to be so that they didn't feel their own shame and their own neediness and their own hurt. That it was just slow over time that you were conditioned into being something that you weren't to please them, to get a little bit of affection. That's the most complicated part of it, because it was so subtle over such a long period of time. And, you know, so much of your personalities develop. I think it's like 80% of your personalities develop before you're like 4 years old. I'm not exact on the numbers, but so, you know, you're conditioned before there's any logical thought. It's ingrained in you. So to go and understand the conditioning before you even could ever have memories of it, for me, that's the hardest part to figure out and to work through. And that's all feeling. Like, you can't think your way out of this. You have to feel your way through it. And your body knows. Your body knows more than your mind will ever know. So sitting with those feelings and feeling them and following them down to where they lead, like, that's where the answers are. Nobody wants to do this work. This work sucks. It's hard. It's painful. It's humiliating. It's degrading. It's just everything negative. But when you go through and you find the answers to how I have fucked up my life so many times and self-sabotage and gone down the wrong paths just not to feel pain, when you go into that pain and you sit with it and you make friends with it and you become stronger than it, your life gets so much easier. It's just the point of committing to doing it.
So let's do the recap of your significant romantic life.
Oh, that's, thank you. The wound is almost healing. Thanks for picking at the scab.
How old were you when you got married?
It was probably very late 20s.
And you were married for how long?
About 11 years. Yeah.
And then when was it that you met, I don't know what her name is.
Francine, with the car accident. It was right after the marriage, as it was ending. We ran into each other and we both decided to wait until I finished my business at home. I've known her since I was 5, but we didn't run in the same circles. My mother and her mother were friends. And when I had lost my business, I ended up spending a lot of time on Facebook and connecting all people from high school again. And we put a reunion together. We reconnected there and I had no interest. She didn't have any interest. And then the two of us got invited to a mutual friend's wedding. And that's when we reconnected and we ended up realizing that we had a lot in common and we took it from there. We realized that we liked each other. I knew I had some stuff to take care of and she definitely was not going to get into anything until that was done, which was a smart move. And I had told her, I said, don't expect me to rush this. And she's like, I don't expect that. And I'm like, well, I hope you're here on the other side. And she was. And then we dated for about a year and, we were in Florida She was like, I want to talk to you. And I'm like, don't break up with me on vacation. I can't handle the plane ride home next to you, you know? And she was like, you're the first real man I ever met. I traveled the world 7 times over. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. I'm moving back to Long Island and I want to merge families. How do you feel about that? And I was like, I love it. This is great. I'm so happy. And she was concerned because she had gained like 3 pounds and we were down in Florida. It was warm. So she wanted to get her running in to knock off some pounds. And I was like, don't go to the right, go up to the beach because there's a sidewalk. And she was like, well, if I don't come back, will you come looking for me? I'm like, of course. Never came back, found her at the hospital. You know, she didn't know who I was for a couple of months. She has a couple of pounds of metal holding her together, traumatic brain injury. And, you know, at some point, you can't feel what you need to feel because I had to take care of her, her mother, and everything. So it was really high functioning considering what was going on inside of me. We got her back. She had lived in Jersey. I was on Long Island at that point. And when we had gotten back, I actually had time and space where it wasn't caretaking 24/7. And then the feelings and the emotions that I had pushed down had started to come up and I started to fall apart. And, you know, she had a lot of work to do and couldn't deal with my breakdown at that point. So she had ended it and it was pretty tough. And it's so interesting because I feel like before that life was good. You know, even though I'd lost the business and was going through the divorce and all that, I just always felt pretty good about where I was personally and emotionally. And ever since that day, I never realized how it really had fucked me up for friendships and intimate relationships. The thought of any kind of loss, I just couldn't handle. So, you know, I always say the amount of joy I'm going to allow myself to have is based on the amount of loss I feel like I can handle. I felt like I couldn't handle any loss. So there was very little joy or anything positive in my life. I was kind of stuck and stagnant. And, you know, people would try to get close to me and I would just bolt. Like it was like, wait, what's that? A feeling? Is there an emotional attachment? I got to go. And it took me a while for that to start to ease. And I was able to start getting closer a little here and a little there, but I never really thought I was ever going to have that feeling with anybody ever again. Like it was so remarkable how you just kind of won. You know, there's no other outside world. You kind of know each other on a deep level. You can take care of each other without caretaking. I can't really truly explain it. We just had this sync to us that was like nothing else I'd ever experienced before. And I had missed it for a long time, but then I was afraid, like, you know, if I get close to somebody and they go away, I knew I wasn't ready to handle it. You know, the way it ended and the way she cut me loose had felt very familiar to my childhood. So I felt like I had worked on my abandonment issues, even though I really hadn't. It did to some degree, but that felt like it opened up a huge, huge wound. And I really hadn't been the same since then until very recently. I'm talking within the last few months. It was the abandonment that I'd felt of, I showed up for you. I showed up for your family. I kind of abandoned myself and put my own hurt and grieving aside to get you healthy. And then it was like, okay, now I'm hurting. And she told me to go fuck myself. So that felt like childhood to me. That hurt lasted for a very long time. I mean, I couldn't shake it. And it was always the what ifs. And, you know, my heart was still attached for, I'm talking 4 or 5 years after, like, I just could not let go of it. I feel like I've done the work. It's not painful talking about it. I don't have that emotional attachment. I feel like I've grieved it out of me. After the breakup, I went out pretty hard, you know, just kind of slept around to numb out. Like I've always been an emotional person and I had no feelings and no emotions. And that ran its course at some point where it was like, I'm tired of this life. I'm tired of putting on an act. I'm tired of pretending. I'm tired of not feeling. And I took about 3 years off where I did not date anyone. And you get to sit in your loneliness and your sadness and, you know, the shame, you know, when you're a child and you're told you're wrong or you do something wrong, you're put into isolation. So when I'm alone, I had always felt shame. So I always had people around me, which is part of the reason I'm so codependent. So I wanted to be alone for a couple of years, and I just didn't engage with family, friends, or relationships. And I did a lot of work. And the first relationship out of that 3 years was brutal, because I'm like, yeah, I got this now. And man, did it all come up, and it came up hard. And it's the body reactions. It's the panic. It was that day of the accident, plus all the childhood abandonment, where, you know, when I felt something wasn't right, I felt like she may be leaning elsewhere, or this may end, this reaction happened in my body that I have no control over. And it's frightening. And I think about being a grown man and feeling these intense fears and panic and just, you know, terror, like it feels like you're going to die. And it's like, really, you're a grown man. It's a breakup. Relax, bro. And I'm like, but I can't relax. I'm in panic. This is like flashbacks. So it was still hard when I first started dating again.
And how long did that one last?
That was a couple of months. It's a funny story. So I started to get this weird feeling, and I'm like, something's not right. Like I can just feel it. And so I'm like, did I miss something? So I opened up the dating app that we had met on, and I looked, and I'm like, wow, those pictures look familiar on our profile. Oh yeah, I took those.
Oh yeah, I forgot about this. Oh yes.
And I was like, so I called her out on it, and she was just like, what? And she ended up taking me to see Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga's last performance at Radio City.
Yeah, she was
loaded. So she goes, wait, introducing you to all my friends and spending all that money on that concert doesn't mean anything? I said, yeah, that absolutely makes up for fucking other men when you told me you weren't. And she had the nerve to tell me I was mean. I was like, I'm mean. Okay, got it. So then I just kind of loosely dated for a little while. And then, you know, I was kind of just seeing one or two people, seeing where it was going to go. And I picked up my phone because I'd gotten an alert from one of the apps. And I looked at the picture, and I'm like, this woman is absolutely stunning. There is no way I'm going out with her. I'm going to be way too insecure in this. And I was kind of like, you know what? You're a different guy now. Just go and just see how it is. And 20 minutes into the date, I felt like I knew her for a long time, and I felt like I could see through, you know, the beauty and, you know, the image that had shown up. And I was hooked big time. It was funny because, you know, I'm like, how do I do this? Like, I know I'm going to be a mess trying to play it cool for the next couple of days before I contacted her. So I walked her to a corner, and she goes, all right, I'm right here. And I was like, all right. I said, listen, I just want to tell you, I said, a really great time. I'm going to drive myself crazy for the next 24 to 48 hours to figure out how to be cool and contact you and see if you're still interested. So I'm just going to tell you right now, I had a great time. I would love to see you again. Mm. And she turned her head like almost like a confused dog. Like, what? She was like, okay. And I don't think she knew how to process it. And that was what was different with that relationship. I kind of kept showing up as me and not playing games. And I was honest, and I was very, very vulnerable in ways that I had never really truly been. I knew I liked her. I knew that we both felt something, and I just had to do it differently. And I just was very vulnerable.
When you said that within 20 minutes, felt like you knew her, sometimes that could be like a red flag, right? So how do you differentiate between this is a good feeling versus this is my attachment getting activated?
Well, I think it gets easier the more you pay attention to it. And, you know, I kept thinking about that a lot. I mean, there was some, you know, there was some things that were trauma bond. There is that no matter who you date, no matter how much work you do, there's always going to be some level of trauma bond. But she was different in a lot of ways. And since Francine with the car accident, I have not felt that strongly about anybody. And I did not think I was ever going to feel that again. So there was fear crept in big time. You know, I mean, for the first month or so, I'd wake up pretty much in a panic every day, wondering, you know, did she get hit by a car? Is she going leaving? Is this somebody else? Like, I kept having those flashbacks the more my heart got involved. She had no idea I was a fucking wreck until noon every day, you know. But I just paid attention to it. And I tried to see, you know, Am I trying to heal something? Am I trying to fill a void? You know, am I being codependent? Am I showing up, you know, with confidence? You know, why am I here? What's turning me on about this? What turns me off? What do I like? What don't I like? And trying the things that I didn't like, I tried to see if it was just my ego and my past issues, you know, because I have a habit of not paying attention when I don't get my needs met, because I need somebody to blame. And instead of being all angry and, you know, withholding and withdrawing and putting up walls, I took a look at it. And I have a friend that I trust, and I would call him up and I go, am I crazy here for feeling this way? And he's like, you're absolutely 100% wrong. I'm like, I don't hear that often. He goes, I know, but you're wrong. And he kind of kept me on track for a while to get through the beginning rough patches until we kind of settled in and we knew that we were going to be together for a while.
And the emotional flashbacks stopped mostly?
Yeah, they definitely eased up. You know, the more time together, when I realized that, you know, I wasn't going to wake up and she was going to tell me we're done, or, you know, I had to take that whole car accident thing out of my head. Like every time I would leave her apartment, I usually would walk home and it's like almost 50 block walk, you know, and at the beginning, I would walk home all the time instead of taking the subway so I can kind of get my nervous system down, because I was always had that car accident fear. But after a while, it, you know, just working through it and talking it out with somebody and, you know, realizing that the fear isn't in the moment, it's from the past, and, you know, work through where it pretty much went away after a while.
What a miracle. Until it didn't.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine what it was like for you to get to that place and feel comfortable, and then to sense that shift
in this most recent one.
Yeah, like when you finally sense a shift, are you freaking out?
Well, it was. I mean, I was up in Pennsylvania. I came back and I talked to her on the phone, and she got off quick and she said, I'll text you later. And I thought that was about going out. And I thought it was just kind of weird the way she had said it. And then I got a text. Do we need to talk? I think we need to talk, don't you? And I'm like, no, I don't. And I'm like, what's going on? She's like, I think we need to talk. So we met for dinner, and I was like, I asked her what was going on. And you know, I didn't feel all of that abandonment come up. Like it was just, I figured there was just something had come up, and, you know, we kind of talked it through and we were back on track, and she got scared. She got scared because, you know, she was like, I love you. You're my best friend. Like, and I'm like, and you want to end it because why? Like, it's a weird way to lean into it. But I think it was that she was feeling so strongly that it was freaking her out. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she thought she could go and open up more. And she probably knew that that's what I was wanted
emotionally.
But the thing is, I felt like we could do it together because we had so many of the same issues. Like, and we would talk about it at the beginning. I'm like, it's crazy how similar we are. We took the relationship very slow, and like I liked it because we got to, as we were going slow, it's easier to see and identify the issues. Mm-hmm. And where people are uncomfortable and why. And so much of it was so similar, and we kind of worked through it together, which was really nice. And then I think she just got to a point where it was like, you know what, this experiment's over. I want to go back to what my life was before this.
How was the dialogue in your head different during this breakup than it was in past relationships?
Well, when she was like, we have to talk, I didn't internalize it like I wasn't good enough.
Mm.
You know, normally it would be this panic, and it's like, you know, you're spiraling down this drain of just worthlessness and, you know, loser and not good enough and abandonment. And I was like, I didn't really feel any of that. And the reason I didn't feel that is because, and you asked me how I did this differently, I showed up as me really for the first time ever in this way. I was open. I was honest. I was genuine. I was vulnerable. You know, I was emotional, you know, like the manly shit you never tell a woman. I would voice it. You know, I'm like, that made me feel really insecure. Here are the 8 reasons why. It has nothing to do with you, but I didn't want to act weird and have you feel it. And that was so hard to do. So, and we all have, I did an episode called Cut and Burn. We all have that cut and burn point in relationships, right? So for me, there's a certain point of either betrayal or disrespect that as soon as it hits, I'm like, fuck you. I am out of here. This, you know, I'm really hurt, but I'm going to be angry at you so I don't feel my hurt. And this time, as hurt as I was, I didn't cut and burn. And I talked myself through that point that I had never gotten past before. And there was so much value on the other side of that cut and burn point. There is so much to learn about yourself. You know, pride and ego and family history and childhood shit that stops you from being vulnerable, open, and loving past the point where your feelings are hurt. There's so much more on the other side of that. And I just kept going into it and I kept getting further into it. And, you know, even the last time we were together, I mean, I just laid it all out there, you know, and it was humiliating and it was embarrassing and it was revealing. It was transparent.
I thought it was badass from what you shared with me. So
well, from a guy's point of view, it's hard for me to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I loved her so much that I wasn't going to let past childhood abuse, all of that shit, my ego, my pride, my macho bullshit get in the way this time. So when it ended, yeah, I was angry. Yeah, I was hurt. You know, she could have handled some of it so much better. So could I. But if I didn't get past that cut and burn point and really humble myself, which is what it felt like, I wouldn't have learned what I learned, and I wouldn't have known without a shadow of a doubt that I gave it everything I humanly possibly could, and I have nothing to feel bad about. Mm-hmm. And that is great. And even after the breakup, you know, my thing is, let me go out and, you know, start eating pills, drinking bourbon, and sleeping around so I don't have to feel anything. You know, I want to feel wanted. I want to feel valued. I want somebody to be interested in me to fill that empty void that just left. And I didn't do any of that. I sat at home a lot, I got to be honest with you, but I sat in the shame and the hurt and the pain and the rejection, the betrayal and the abandonment. And I worked through it to the point where, like, I feel really good right now because I took the time and I missed the best part of the weather in New York. It was like September and October. It's beautiful here. And I'm sitting in my apartment every day. Right. By the time I felt better, I got out there. I got ski gloves and a ski hat and a scarf, but I didn't care about missing out because I needed to heal. I needed to take care of myself. I needed to be there for me, and I had nothing to give anybody else. And I didn't want to leave a wake of hurt in my way like I always had before. Like, I took my shit out on people in front of me because I was in so much pain, and they would scratch their head and go, I don't understand. It was going great. And you left. And it was like, well, I got what I needed. So now I'm gone. And that's a shitty human being right there. And I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that at this point in your recovery, that even if you had tried to, like, go out and sleep, it wouldn't work anymore. You know, I don't even think you would get any sort of relief.
It's a postponement of grieving. That's mm-hmm. what it is. Sooner or later, you're going to have to grieve, whether it's, you know, in 6 months or 16 years. But postponing the grief, it's like this dull, aching pain that lasts with you day in and day out until you actually do the work of grieving. I had to grieve the loss of this relationship like a death. Like, I was hurt and my life completely changed.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big void in it. And there's a lot of empty time that has to be filled that used to be filled with her. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, how am I going to fill this, negatively or positively? And, you know, it was a better choice. And the grieving didn't last as long and drawn out because I was numbing out for so long. I just sat in it and I just was hating life every single day. But there was a love and a care and an understanding for myself at that point that I usually don't have. Like, who wants to sit in that?
No, it's garbage.
So I was listening to your episode from this week about fear. Oh. And I thought you had some interesting shit to say. The one that I thought was really interesting, it's something that I've thought about when you were talking about just like knowing that the fear is there, but not being able to identify what it is. I thought about that a lot too. Like with an adult child, the core problem are these faulty beliefs and fears that we hold. But in order to reprogram, we have to know what those are. And that can be hard.
It is. I mean, I haven't talked about it a lot in the past. It's recently, I've been talking more about like the abandonment issue for me, because that's still the one that I struggle with the most. And intellectually, I understand it. It makes complete sense why I would have the internal reaction that I have, but I can't seem to catch myself. It, you know, the nervous system ratchets up, the self-hate kicks in, and I just fall into an abyss. And I don't understand why exactly or how to stop it. It doesn't last as long as it used to. Mm-hmm. So there's a point of intellectually knowing why the fear is there, and then slowly start moving into the fear emotionally to start feeling it. So I know a lot of things intellectually, but mm-hmm. I can't fix them or heal them until I re-experience the pain of the wound that, mm-hmm. that comes up. And this one for me is extremely difficult to get a handle on.
What is one fear that you feel like you've worked through?
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. And now I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I guess a lot of it is the vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very guarded. I was a people pleaser. I was a showman. I put on a facade. Nobody was really going to get to the bottom of me. Nobody was going to see. And I show up now more vulnerable and real. And I show people who I am more, and I'm less afraid of being judged for mm-hmm. what I had thought was unlovable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would imagine obviously the podcast helps with that, but I would imagine working with people one-on-one too plays a role in that. So I was wondering if there's been anything that you've noticed as far as coaching people one-on-one, how that's been a healing process for you.
It's very validating. You know, you have somebody sitting across from you going into places that you have previously been alone mm-hmm. and they show up with it. And you can relate. And then you have the conversation about it. And the more people that I coach that come up with the same, I mean, the feelings underneath are the same. It's how we got to those feelings that we try to uncover. But the validation of just not being alone in this anymore and having people show up and express and trust you enough to be vulnerable with you allows me to be more vulnerable with myself in sessions, mm-hmm. that I get to carry that forward in life. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a safe place to be you, and it's a mm-hmm. safe place to go to your deep and your dark and your fears and things that you don't want others to see publicly. And we're doing it privately. Like, I wish the whole world could be that way. And I know it's unrealistic, but it gives you a sense of who you are and what you went through, that you don't have to be ashamed of it because you're not the only one anymore, or you don't feel like you're the only one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then also just having the belief that healing is possible, which I think is, you know, hard. I think I talked about this in my episode this week as well, about just how we have this belief that we're inherently flawed and unfixable, and getting to a point where, I mean, I think in order for us to begin healing, we have to just have the tiniest bit of faith that things could get better, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's the shame that keeps us isolated. So I, you know, I don't make mistakes. I'm just one big mistake. So I have to use a lot of energy to be perfect when I enter the world and show myself. And then I isolate the rest of the time and try to get up strength and energy to put on this facade so nobody can see through it. Coming out of hiding is a huge part of this healing. See, I'm ashamed and I'm embarrassed by who I am. So I'm not going to show anybody that. By coming out and showing myself imperfect, messy, vulnerable, raw, real, that's hard. That's hard because people are putting on a facade to look shiny to cover up rust, mm-hmm. right? You're painting over this rust and eventually the rust goes through and you have to constantly keep painting over. What we really need to do is sand down that rust, get to the metal and then paint it so the rust don't come through. But the hard part is pushing through and being seen imperfect. Because if I was ever less than perfect, I was abandoned, I was hit, I was abused, I was punished. So I learned real quick that you better be real shiny, real glossy, because anything else is not acceptable.
I talk a lot about how blame blocks us from healing. And I know that it's something that you talk a lot about as well. So I was hoping that you could speak to that.
Yeah, because blame is, you know, I waited for apologies for decades. You know, I blamed my entire life was the excuse for me functioning and taking responsibility for my own actions and my own well-being. When you blame, you just keep yourself in the victim role. It's an excuse. And listen, I needed to blame to survive. That was my only coping mechanism for a while. But it keeps me a victim. I keep putting it on somebody else. It's your fault. You did this to me. I need you to say the words and to love me the way I need to be loved so that I will be healed. See, I've given up all my responsibility to my abusers. When I stopped blaming and actually took responsibility for my own healing, that's empowering. Like I ran out of like my biggest excuse. So then mm-hmm. when I stop blaming, that puts me more into the self-hate and more into the shame, and it gets me closer to the trauma. Blame for me, and listen, it's so easy, and I would love to do it sometimes. Sometimes, you know, if I'm biking and somebody cuts me off, I'm going to blame him for breaking my flow. I mean, you're still going to blame somebody somewhere. But the empowerment that you get when you start to take, nobody's going to do this work for you. And if these people in your life that did abuse you, that made you feel worthless, if they're not going to show up and do this for you, you are the only one. So you have a choice. For me, it was when I first started to stop blaming, it was very confusing because that was a way of getting in touch with my anger to put it on somebody else instead of dealing with it on my own. And it just keeps you in this endless loop. Nothing ever changed for me the more I blamed. As soon as I stopped blaming, almost everything changed. because you have to do the work. You're the one that has to emotionally go through this, even though it wasn't your fault. It's your life. And it become your life has to become your responsibility at some point. And you can choose to sit on a couch or lay in a bed and just wither away in blame to nothing and not do anything for yourself. Or you can go for treatments and try to have a positive attitude and keep healthy and work to beat this, to just beat it, not let it beat you. That's what it comes down to. You have to beat your abuse. You have to beat your trauma. You have to empower yourself to become stronger than it. And if you don't, nobody is going to do it for you. What kind of life do you want? Do you want blame and sit in sadness, or do you want to be empowered and feel good?
Yeah. And it's not just having the trauma and abuse go into remission. It's not just beating that, but we also get to live a life of depth and meaning and get to know who our true selves are and live with purpose. So, you know, the rewards of it are much greater than just dealing with the abuse and trauma.
There's no end to it when you blame. It's just a loop that you're not going to get out of. At least when you start taking responsibility, it will get a lot worse, the pain, the emotional pain, before it gets better. But when it gets better, how much lighter and how empowered, and the possibilities in your life just vastly open up, and you now have choices. Because when trauma is driving you, you don't have any choices. You are just reacting out of fear and panic. When that starts to subside, your head gets clearer. You can make choices and set boundaries based on what feels right for you. It's all about getting to know yourself without the trauma there.
I asked people if they had questions. So this is what Rick said. He goes, how about some advice for someone starting out on this journey? Someone who is a jumbled mess, full of information overload and heading off into 30 different directions all at once, starting things and moving on to something else halfway through. I can relate, Rick, not because of lack of interest, just finding the next shiny object. LOL. I guess much of the way I've run my entire, alcoholic life.
Well, I think a lot of that is we don't know who we are, right? So when we start doing this work, we're in 800 different directions. We are trying, we're not trying to feel good. We're just trying not to feel bad.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for like a life preserver to give me some kind of good feeling as I'm doing this incredibly difficult, painful work. And I kept bouncing out to different things, and some things would satisfy me for a little while and wear off quick, and other things I would try didn't speak to me at all. So the bouncing around and being in 800 different directions, I think is, for me, was part of the process. And I always explain it as a funnel. It's that wide end of the funnel at the beginning where I'm bouncing off of every edge, trying to find something to grab onto. I start to realize that a lot of it doesn't mean what I thought it was going to mean. And I start going down that funnel towards the spout where it gets narrower. Mm-hmm. So I start to find things and hold on to them and live them more, and they feel good more in an authentic way without applause. See, I'm codependent. I need a narcissistic supply. So I'm always looking for applause. Mm-hmm. What I ended up doing was weaning off of the applause and trying to find stuff that made me feel good without anybody around. Mm-hmm. And then they became part of my daily life. And I still do a lot of them to this day. And I need them to keep me centered and on track. So I think it's normal to be bouncing around at the beginning. You will start to refine who you are. And things that I did find comfort in, say, 3 years ago, they don't speak to me as much now. So they've kind of, I've let them go, but I've picked up other things. So you're refining who you are and figuring out as you go along, and it's narrowing down that funnel to the narrow end of the spout. And then you get comfortable there and you know who you are. And then it's the reverse. So now you're in that spout. Now there's another funnel on the other side. Mm-hmm. Then your world starts to open. So you have to narrow down to figure out who you are, become mm-hmm. safe in the world that you're living in and comfortable and confident. And then you start slowly moving out and widening again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You hear that, Rick? Okay. I'm another one.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, Rick. We love you, Rick. Okay. So somebody asked me, I don't know how to word this as a specific question, but something about I'm dealing with is very suppressed memories surfacing the more I heal. Maybe if you could talk something about that, how the stuff you lost starts to come back. Because at this point I'm like, in my life, I'm like, well, fuck, why now? I know you've experienced this.
Yeah. So I guess the easiest way to explain it is I bury parts of me. There were certain things that weren't acceptable. So I tuck them away. I don't even know they're tucked away. They're just so far away that I don't even know they're in me. I have 1,000 layers of defenses that keep me from feeling this feeling. I start with the top layer. And for most of us, it's addiction, right? That's for me was the top layer. Let's peel away the addiction and let's see what's under it. And it's like, fuck no, please. That is way too painful. Give me the booze back, please. So when you take away the addiction, you start to feel. The reason the addiction's there is not to feel.
Yep.
As you take those top layers away and you start feeling more, you get comfortable with the discomfort of those feelings and you learn how to manage them and they almost start to dissipate. Every layer that I pull away has the same feel after. I feel light. I feel airy. I feel good. I feel comfortable. I feel confident. Whether it's a day, a week, or a month, all of a sudden feelings start to rise. I created space within me. The next layer starts to come up. Then I start to deal with those feelings. Where, what are they? Why are they there? Where are they leading? Why do I feel uncomfortable? And I start to work through that and sit with them and process and write and talk about it. Until that light bulb clicks, I get that moment of clarity where I start to smile and feel good and I've conquered this next layer. And then we walk nice for a little while and then boom, the next one comes up. It's a never-ending process. The thing is, you get better at your process.
Yeah.
So I'm at the point now when I'm leaning into uncomfortable. I'm leaning into vulnerable. I'm leaning into the pain because I know on the other side of that is joy.
So what does that look like? What does leaning into pain look like for you?
A lot of it is sitting very still and quiet and trying not to attach emotionally or mentally to the pain. So I like to go into my head because it takes away the feelings. When I can't handle the thought process and it's looping too much, I go into hate, self-hate and worthlessness. And then that'll drag me into my shame. So I try to stay somewhere in the middle, neutral, where I don't attach the thoughts. I don't attach the feelings. And I breathe into the pain and the discomfort. And I pay attention to where it is in my body. And I let it start to, because I keep it all in my chest. So I relax my chest and it goes up into my head and my head starts to throb. Like, so emotions are energy in motion. I've stuffed energy down. It wants to come up and be felt. So I allow that energy to take over my entire body as I'm laying there. At some point, it will lead me to thoughts, feelings, emotions, memories. And it's like, click. When I was 9, this happened, and I've been reacting the same way over and over and over again. I understand why the reaction is there and why my body is reacting the way it is. And then I don't, my body does not react as intense the next time this comes up. And I just keep working it and working it. And I keep going back to it. I basically am putting myself back as a 9-year-old child emotionally. And I'm feeling the fear and the terror and the abandonment and the hurt and the abuse that that 9-year-old felt. As an adult, and I'm teaching myself that I am stronger than the feelings my nervous system and body is producing.
So this is from Colleen Coco. She's like your number one fan, the one that writes all of your notes down or all of your episodes down. Yeah. Okay. So she says this, the subject is family systems boundaries. You talk about when you do the work and you start to change, and your emotional caregiver role no longer serves the family system. This can cause the emotionally unhealthy family member to be triggered and lash out in anger. In this scenario, when the unhealthy family member is presenting an entirely delusional idea about who you are as a person, because you are no longer serving an emotional need, and there is no use in defending the delusion, How are you able to come to acceptance and continue to proceed with a relationship? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, how much time do we have? There's a lot there.
To unpack there right now.
You know, I'll talk from my perspective. I didn't know who I was. I created a false self to be loved and to survive. So I had to be these certain things. If I wasn't those things, I got punished, abused, criticized, shamed, whatever. I don't know who I am because I had to abandon myself. So I always codependent relied on other mirroring faces to tell me who I was and if I was good or bad because I didn't know it in me. I believed what the mirrors were around me. So I became this nice guy, people pleaser, caretaker. And when I was that, I got back what I needed in my family system. But I never took the time to know who I was. So by cutting out my family and taking the time to sit in my shame, to understand my role, to find out who I am, you see, I never really thought I was a good person. I never thought that I had worth and value. So when I would set boundaries in my family and they would guilt me and shame me, I would internalize that, like, they were right, I was wrong, I can't set these boundaries anymore. And then I would abandon myself over and over and over again. I had to take the time and do the work to figure out who I was. I can now show up with people in my life that I have a specific role with, and they can try to guilt and shame me into becoming what they want me to be so they don't feel uncomfortable and not let it affect me. But it takes a lot of time. I mean, saying no in a family system when you are the people pleaser, when you are the caregiver, it's not allowed. So I had to start off very slow with saying no. It would be like, you know, your aunt's coming in from Rockland County this weekend, you know, all the cousins coming, can you get the kids and come in? And normally I would be like, I would cancel all the plans with my kids and I'd make myself available and show up because that's what I'm supposed to do. That's my role. Mm-hmm. It got to the point where it was like, no, sorry, I already had plans. And they would guilt and shame me and I can hear it. And then I would get texts from family who were there. Where are you? How come you're not here? And I just had to ignore it, you know, or I would say I had previous plans with the kids. The thing is, it's the way we deal with it internally, right? So they're going to shame and guilt us, and that's going to set us on fire inside. We're no good. We feel our shame. We feel not good enough. We feel not lovable. We're not in our role. People aren't going to like us. We're going to be kicked out of this family system if we don't abide by their rules. It's learning how to deal with that internal body reaction when you do start setting boundaries. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the point where it doesn't even bother you anymore. Like people are people, you know, even if it's not in your family system, you have friends that used to you a certain way and you're just not in the mood to put up with their bullshit one day. And you're like, yeah, bro, I'm not going. And it's like, what do you mean? How can you not go? And you learn how not to let it affect you. Start paying attention to the body reactions that you have and start to learn how to manage them and pause at that trauma response. When you get that trigger, you know, you're going to fawn, you're going to flee, you're going to fight. Take a moment and just let those feelings wash over you and give it that moment that it needs where you don't get that default reaction. Start paying attention to how your body reacts and how you react after you're triggered. It's about dismantling your triggers. People can say whatever they want about me. And if I am in a mentally and emotionally healthy place, most of the time I am not going to be triggered. Mm-hmm. Because I've worked on the body reactions where it doesn't matter anymore what they think or what they say. So it's finding out who you are, understanding your body reactions, and trying to kind of just dismantle the triggers.
Yeah. And the last thing she said, how are you able to come to acceptance and continue to proceed with the relationship? I mean, my understanding is that you don't have a relationship with your parents, right?
I recently, started getting back in touch with my mother and father.
Good.
After all the time away, they're pretty cautious with me. I haven't seen them much, but they don't want me leaving now. You see, I left, it crushed them, and I had to leave for my own reasons. And I really truly wasn't trying to like put the dagger in and turn it. I just didn't account for their emotional feelings anymore. And I've taken care of my own. And then, you know, the result of it is they got hurt. So I've gone back and I've spent time with them a little here and a little there. And I get to go back as me, not their son, not the caretaker, not the role. I came back as who I am. And if they guilt and shame me, which they haven't yet, and I don't know when that's going to happen, but it will happen at some point, I can actually just look at them now and go, well, that's who they are. They don't know any better. And I am healthier place. I don't need to react. I don't need to take this personally. I do not need to internalize it. And I do not need to push back, tell them they're wrong, get angry, get sad about, or feel bad about myself. It doesn't, it gets to the point where it just doesn't matter. And that's such a great place to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like I had something similar with my dad too, where like I took a significant break in the relationship and it allowed me to get kind of the power back in the relationship some.
And that's it's the power, right? So here's the thing. This is what I never realized. They needed me more than I needed them. I just never knew that until I left. So there was a dependency both ways. They made me codependent. They made me emotionally dependent. They made me needy from them. And they made me think that I needed them more than they needed me. But in reality, they don't. And I can tell you, if somebody keeps trying to guilt you and shame you when you're setting boundaries, if you do not give in, they're going to have to make a choice at some point. Mm-hmm. They're either going to have to change the way they interact with you, mm-hmm. or they're basically going to tell you to go fuck yourself. Mm-hmm. And either way, for me, I feel like you win. If they tell me to go fuck myself, that's great, because now all the pressure's off me. They walked away. And if they change how they interact with me, I win also, because now I'm not giving into their guilt and shame. It's holding firm. Sooner or later, they have to see that it's not working. And if you keep trying something 20, 30, 40 times and you're not getting the results you want, you're going to try a different way. How about just being fucking honest? Mm-hmm. You know, be honest with me. Don't control me. Don't manipulate me. Don't guilt me. Just say you're not feeling enough love for me and you'd like a hug. That's not so fucking difficult.
Mm-hmm. So what have you noticed in the way that they're interacting with you?
They're cautious. You know, one of my parents, I think I think my father's just kind of entertaining it because it's more important to my mother. I'm not really sure. But when I sat down with them, you know, I trained it out to Long Island. We met at a diner and we sat down and I was like, you know, so how are we going to do this? And she's like, I don't know. I said, are we going over the past? Are you going to go down that road? Or are we just going to pretend it didn't happen? Hmm. And she goes, I'm not going back in the past. I said, okay, I think I'm good with that. I've done enough work. I've satisfied it in myself. I don't need anything from you in that respect. I said, so we'll just take it from here. You will never hear another word about anything that ever happened in the past from me again. And the next two or three times that I saw them, it was polite. It was, you know, it was like running into an old neighbor that you hadn't seen in a while. There was none of that family dynamic. There was none of that emotional undercurrent where you could just feel your stomach starting to churn. Like there was nothing. It was nice, light, airy, and easy. I think, you know, the rest of my family still telling me to go fuck myself, I'm pretty sure. And it's ironically, I was just at a wake on Long Island on Tuesday. And I walked up the stairs and there was my sister and my brother-in-law who I hadn't seen or spoken to in 5 years. So I just walked over and said hello and walked away. You know, the anger was hurting me more mm-hmm. than it was hurting them at this point. It was my protection. I needed to tell them to fuck off. I needed to isolate. I needed to work on my guilt and my shame. But there was a point where I'd done enough work on it that the anger was just eating me away because I was holding on to something that didn't need to be held on to. I don't need them to apologize. I don't need them to be nice to me. I don't need them to like me. I don't need them in my life. So the anger was keeping me bound to them in a very negative, unhealthy way. So, you know, I had a big problem with my sister. I felt more betrayed by her in the last 20 years than anybody else in my family. And that took me a while to get over. And now it's like, it doesn't matter because I become a prisoner to my anger and my resentment. Mm-hmm. I don't have the freedom. Like, if I didn't go say hi to them, how uncomfortable would the rest of that wake been? Where the three of us are in this room where people are mourning and, you know, you're in your head and you can feel the emotions coming. I had none of that. I said hello and I walked away. And I never thought about them again after that. If I didn't say anything, I would have been obsessing the entire time. Do I go over to them? What do they think? Are they going to come over and talk to me? If they do come over, what am I going to say? How should I be? Should I be angry? Standoffish? Should I hug her? Should I be nice? There was none of that.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.